When legacy automation starts impacting visibility and downtime, it may be time to consider modernization. Graybar's automation specialists work alongside your team to help you identify risks and map out realistic upgrade paths without unnecessary disruptions. Get started with a free health check of your operations and see what's possible. Yep, Graybar does that.
Baseball fans, think you know who's hitting a homer today? Well, FanDuel is giving you a free chance to call your shot with daily dingers. Joining the action is easy. Just make your free pick on who's hitting a home run in their game, and if you're right, you'll get a profit boost to use on your next bet for a chance at extra winnings. You've got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. And don't forget, you can make a free pick every day during the MLB season. It's just another reason why FanDuel is the home for home runs. So, are you ready to play your game today? Join all the action at FanDuel.com/podcast. That's FanDuel.com/podcast to play daily dingers and make your free pick on who's hitting a homer. Play ball and swing for the fences on FanDuel, an official partner of the MLB.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Baseball has always been a game of inches. Now, it's also a game of seconds. T-Mobile and MLB have teamed up to bring ABS Challenge to all 29 ballparks across the U.S. This isn't a minor upgrade. This is the most significant new technology in the history of the sport, and it's powered by T-Mobile. With every pitch thrown, ABS Challenge uses real-time precision to verify the call, giving them the support they need. No delays, no guesswork, just accuracy at the speed the game demands. Thanks to ABS Challenge, T-Mobile is helping power the moments that define the game. When performance and reliability are non-negotiable, MLB turns to T-Mobile. That's not a coincidence. That's what happens when the most innovative network in the country powers the most data-driven sport in the world. T-Mobile powers MLB's most ambitious technology, and America's best network powers your connection to baseball, home or away, every pitch, every game, every day. T-Mobile, it's better over here.
Major League Baseball trademarks and copyrights are used with permission of Major League Baseball. Visit MLB.com. T-Mobile, best mobile network in the U.S., according to Ookla speed test, based on analysis by Ookla of speed test intelligence data, first half 2026. Ookla trademarks used under license and reprinted with permission.
Latte for Keenan?
That's me.
Hey, you're...
Yeah.
Buying a car online on AutoTrader?
Really? But unlike other sites, you can start online, test drive with a local dealer, then finish online or at the dealership.
Really? Wait, are you...
Yep, it's key.
...able to finish in person without starting the process over?
Really? Your info stays with you every step of the way.
Cool. Enjoy.
It's Keenan Thompson. Buy your car online on AutoTrader. Really.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
As much as I would love to say, like, I wish I didn't struggle, it led me to turn pain into purpose and help other people. And it also, I don't know that if I didn't go through that period of struggling, if I would have started a company. So the short answer is I would change nothing.
And our guest this week is Holly Mershon. She was one of the greatest basketball players in the history of Drexel University. Spent several years playing overseas. Now founder of a clothing line, Weightless. So much to talk about. Holly, thanks so much for coming in studio.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
So Weightless, tell me all about it.
Oh, geez, where do I even start? So Weightless is a mental health-driven lifestyle brand that I founded probably at this point 3 years ago, but we didn't actually launch until August of 2025. And it kind of came about after I was done playing basketball. I retired from basketball in 2019 from overseas. And when I transitioned out of the sport, I was struggling with different mental health challenges. My identity and purpose was a big one. Spent my entire life focused on being an athlete, and it felt like my identity, and I felt very lost during that transition. It was a period of grief for me. So I always felt like there was something more for me, but I didn't know what that was until I think it was 2 years after I retired. I was sitting on my sofa with a heavy weighted blanket, and I was like, oh, it'd be cool if there was a heavy hoodie. And I was really just looking to make one for myself. And when I went through the whole process, the manufacturing process and, you know, what everything that it took to put into creating something, I was like, oh, maybe I could do this for a living and create a company out of it. And at the same time, I was also working with a mental health foundation. They're called Quell. And I feel like they really provided me the space to feel comfortable talking about what I was going through. So then from there, I decided to create this company, Weightless, and I came up with a name that resembled how one may want to feel while navigating mental health challenges. And that's how I landed on Weightless, feeling lighter, because mental health, while it's emotional and mental, it can feel very physical. So for me, I had a lot of anxiety, and I felt it a lot in my chest and my stomach. So I wanted to create a company that offered a sense of community and belonging and the feeling that you can talk about your mental health. It's not something to be ashamed of. And at the same time, selling a product that was a tangible reminder that feeling lighter is always possible, that there is light at the end of the tunnel, although it's sometimes hard to see. And we create 100% double knit heavy hoodies. There's not actual weight added to them, but because of the construction, they are a little bit heavier in weight. They kind of feel like a cozy hug when you put it on. So that was pretty long-winded, but that's kind of, you know, how I came about to found Weightless.
So at that moment, when you think about how nice it would be to have a weighted hoodie, what was your knowledge of business and the idea of creating a company? Where were you at that point of understanding any of what you do now?
My knowledge was none. I had no idea what I was doing, and I still have days where I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's kind of been, but that's been the fun part, the journey of learning and figuring it out on your own. Obviously, I've had mentors along the way these past 10 months that have been extremely helpful. My family and friends have been extremely helpful, but I honestly had no idea what I was doing. I will say, I think that if I knew what I was getting myself into, there probably would have been a little bit more hesitation on my end to start a company and try to grow a business. So it was kind of a blessing in disguise that I didn't know anything, just because it's a lot of work. I love what I'm doing. I would not trade it for the world, but every day it's, you know, how do I grow and scale this company? It's a time commitment. And I think, you know, for anyone that's looking to start something, you should be passionate about it and you should be doing it for the right reasons, because I think that if it's not something I was passionate about, I would have probably quit in month one.
It's interesting because a lot of times if you're dealing with anxiety, the last thing you want to do is jump into something you don't understand at all. But at the other point, you talk about identity. Mm-hmm. It would be so alluring to immerse yourself in something that you're passionate about, even if you're not quite sure what the road looks like.
Yeah, 100%. It's funny. I often say that I created a mental health-driven lifestyle brand that has caused me more anxiety, but in the best way. It's a good kind of anxiety because I love it. And when I stopped playing basketball, you know, my athletic career ended, I was very concerned that I would not find something as fulfilling as competing, playing sports. I mean, the past 10 years was focused on basketball, but I was having anxiety over just the fear of, like, is this my life? I'm going to wake up every day, not be passionate, not motivated about anything, not fulfilled. And as soon as I stepped into being an entrepreneur and a founder and growing Weightless, I feel like I am as fulfilled as I was when I was playing basketball. Now, it's different, but I feel like I have purpose again. And that's just such a great feeling.
That was my next question. It's different. How?
So I will say playing basketball, there's a lot of reassurance, but at the same time, someone is also there to tell you like what you're doing wrong. I think the fan base in basketball is always fun. People cheering you on, the wins and losses, even with the losses, there's a lot of fulfillment there because you're learning. There's team dynamics in basketball. You make friends pretty quickly. So that all is fulfilling. So with starting your own company, you're able to, let me backtrack. So when starting my own company, it's The day-to-day is me, 100% me. Obviously, I have people who help me. I have interns. I have family and friends. So I spend a lot of time alone. However, where I find fulfillment is growing my community. And I've started in Philadelphia, and I've grown, you know, a decent community in the Philadelphia area around the Waitlist brand and people being able to connect with our mission. And that is very fulfilling, seeing that. Also, all the people I get to meet on a day-to-day basis, like you being here, I'm not sure that if I didn't start a company that I would ever be sitting here having this conversation with you. So I've gotten to meet a lot of really, really cool people. I'm not sure if that answered the question, but it's just different. I'm not really sure how else to, you know, explain it, but both fulfilling in different ways.
You said that the issues with anxiety, you started to really notice them, or I shouldn't say notice them, but they really came to the forefront once basketball was done.
Yes.
Looking back, do you feel like you had issues with anxiety throughout, but basketball was a way for you to deal with it, you know, or was this something that developed just once that place that basketball filled in your life was gone?
That's a great question. So when I look back, I don't necessarily remember dealing with anxiety in high school and college. I'm sure that basketball was a good distraction. I will say there's two parts to this. So my whole life I've been struggling with OCD and I had no idea. I was diagnosed last summer after listening to someone talk about OCD, the different symptoms, the different types of OCD. And I got diagnosed. So I had an evaluation. And one of the reasons why I ended up getting evaluation outside of hearing someone talk about it was because when I retired from basketball in 2019, my symptoms were heightened. I could tell that like the types of symptoms I was having were getting worse and I wasn't able to avoid them. And while working a full-time job, it was really hard for me to focus. So I definitely did see a difference when I transitioned out of my sport where my OCD did get worse. And I think that basketball really helped manage that for me. Before I retired, I tore both of my ACLs. And I will say, I think that is the first time that I really faced anxiety. And I tore my right knee and then I tore my left knee a year and a half apart. And when I tore my right knee, it was the first time I was really forced to sit out of basketball. I mean, I had sprained ankles, but you would just go back in the locker room, tape it up, and I'd be thrown back in the game like nothing happened. So it was the first time I was really forced to sit out, and it was scary because I didn't know if I would be able to come back from it. So that was the first time that I really dealt with anxiety, but definitely the OCD, I think playing basketball really helped to manage that. It was an outlet, and I didn't even know it was an outlet until I stopped playing.
Well, because so much of it is based on routine and going and shooting 250 free throws until it feels right.
Exactly.
It's not looked at. That's your hard worker. Like, it's very easy. I can absolutely see how we could funnel into it and it just feels like life.
Yep, exactly.
Were the symptoms outward or was it more how your mind would race and work and stuff like that?
It was definitely in my mind, so I'm comfortable talking about this because I've talked about it on my TikTok, but one of my symptoms with OCD is I count things a lot. So, for example, I could be sitting watching TV and there's subtitles on the TV and I'm constantly counting the subtitles and not even paying attention to what happens. And that's something that would happen when I was working full-time and I was on the computer a lot. When I would start to count, it would become overwhelming and then I couldn't focus on what I was doing and I didn't know how to manage it. So when I finally was evaluated, I haven't gotten treatment for OCD, but now that I'm aware of what it is, me being able to acknowledge it has really, really helped me. So the symptoms were definitely more in my head, and just over time, it was really hard for me to focus, but it's gotten a lot easier. Now that I'm open about it and I've told people that I have OCD and what I'm struggling with, and I also talk about it on my social media, so that has really helped me manage it and just being able to acknowledge it.
Has being so open, has it led to any negative feedback because the internet can be terrible?
No.
Really?
I don't want to say not yet, but I haven't gotten any negative feedback. If anything, I've had people thank me for sharing my story. I've had people share their story publicly on like the comments on TikTok saying that they were diagnosed at a young age and that's something that they're navigating. So it's really been positive overall. So, yeah, no, not really.
So what has been the most rewarding part to this point of starting your own company? You talked about community. I'm sure it goes along with that. But
yes,
overall, like, what's been the most rewarding part?
Definitely community. But I think for myself that I'm still going. There's been a lot of moments where I've almost given up. And I think that's where being an athlete comes into play, the mentality of being driven and motivated and not giving up and seeing light at the end of the tunnel. So I think from a personal standpoint, I feel proud that I've been able to stick with this and, you know, hopefully continue to see it through. Also, just seeing, it's hard not to say community, but just seeing the difference that it has made for the people that follow our Instagram or TikTok or the emails that I've received, that me sharing my story has helped them in some way. That has been very rewarding, and it reminds me why I'm doing this. Of course, I'm growing a company and selling a product, but it's so much more than that. And seeing that our mission resonates with so many people has, I mean, meant the world to me, and just kind of is reassuring that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
When you're jumping into something that is just a giant pile of unknown, mm-hmm. what has been the scariest part?
Oh, geez, like literally the unknown. That's a great question. I think some of the scariest parts is like when I do something, I don't have anyone to tell me that I'm doing it right or wrong. So it's kind of, I'm taking a chance and not sure how it's going to pan out. I think also a lot of times I think about the big picture of Weightless and where I want to take it. And I have big, big dreams. And that becomes scary because it becomes overwhelming. And I'm like, I don't know if I can handle this or do this or scale this company. So I really try to focus on what my short-term goals are and, you know, kind of reels me back in. But I think just what you said, the unknown is very scary, not having someone to tell me if I'm doing it the right way. And I still don't know if I'm doing it the right way.
What would you say has been the biggest mistake you've made as a small business owner to this point?
There's a lot of mistakes I've made. I really wish, so if anyone is listening and wants to start their own company, my number one advice is to talk to someone who has done it before you dive in headfirst. Obviously, like I look back and I've learned a lot, but there is a lot that I could have done differently if I would have just really educated myself a little bit more before launching this company. There were moments where I spent way too much money on influencers or content creation, where I could have just done it myself or looked for micro influencers. And one of the most recent mistakes I made was with a manufacturer. I thought that they understood the product that I wanted to develop. We went through 2 samples and I thought I communicated things clearly. And I looked back and I was like, oh, maybe I should have done things differently. But to explain a little bit more, we had a summer launch called the Anchor Collection, and I ordered 150 crewnecks. I'm actually wearing one of them right now. And they got delivered, and the logo was not to the Weightless standard. The thread carried over from each letter. It wasn't even. The letters were different sizes. And I was extremely disappointed. But looking back, you know, it was easy for me to blame the manufacturer, but looking back, I should have done a better job and have been a little bit more clear. So I spent a bunch of money on 150 crewnecks that I didn't think I could sell. However, because of my community and how great they are, they helped me pivot. So what went from the Anchor Collection is now known as the Perfectly Imperfect Crewneck, which kind of is a little bit what Weightless is about. Feeling lighter, the pursuit of feeling lighter, is not a linear path when it comes to your mental health. And neither is being a founder and an entrepreneur. So we pivoted hard. We are selling our crewnecks at a discounted price because I do not feel good about selling them at a full price when they came back a little bit wonky. But there's a lot of mistakes that I've made along the way, but they're learning experiences. And It's hard to grow if you don't go through those setbacks.
Prior to starting this, did you consider yourself a fashion person? Like, No. Were you into it at all?
No, I was into oversized hoodies and sweatpants. So if that's considered fashion, then the answer is yes. But as an athlete, I had someone say to me in college, are you ever going to dress up? Because I would always go to class, practice, sometimes when I went out in like sweatshirts. It was my form of comfort. And that's actually one of the other reasons why I decided to start this brand. Our clothing is oversized. It's something that it's comfortable. It's cozy. It was my source of comfort, my safe. I feel my most, this is going to sound odd, but I feel my most confident in oversized, comfy clothing. But no, was not a fashionista.
I don't think there's anything odd about that at all.
Okay.
You talked about the, you know, when you got it back from the manufacturer and it wasn't exactly what you were looking for. Take me back to the first time that you got a piece of clothing that you designed and it was perfect. It was exactly what you were looking for early on. And what was that moment like? Was it emotional?
Yes. Yes, it was very emotional. So my first prototype that I created came back not right. So the very first prototype that we created for Weightless was, it was close, but it wasn't perfect. And then we went with another manufacturer. I think I went through three or four different manufacturers to get to the quote unquote perfect product. And when it came back, I think I literally sat and just like held it on the sofa for 30 minutes. It felt like a win because I started Weightless 3 years ago and I spent 2 years looking for the right manufacturer and someone that we make a very unique product. It's double knit. It's heavy, 100% cotton. So finding a manufacturer that focuses on knitwear is, it's not impossible, but it's a little bit difficult. So yes, getting that first product was very, very rewarding.
When you got that first one back, that wasn't quite up to what you were looking for. I'm curious, was there a part of you that was like, well, it might be okay? Or were you adamant to yourself, no, I want it to be exactly like I want? Because when you don't know where you're going with this and you've been dealing with the anxiety, I don't want to like push my thoughts onto you, but I would think there'd be a lot of, well, it's close enough and I don't want to cause too much trouble and find reasons why it's good enough. What went through your mind with that?
That definitely crosses your mind, but 100% no. Because also being on like the consumer side of things, when I order something and I pay money and it does not come back as expected, I'm angry. Like I'm very annoyed. So I understood that side of it, being a buyer or a customer of a brand that I shop for. So no, it was not good enough. And I went back to the drawing board and I tried again until I felt like it was perfect. Also, our brand is a premium apparel brand. So I am never going to put something out there that isn't the best that it can be. Now, with the crew neck, it was a little bit different. I was not going to sell it because the logo wasn't perfect, but we were able to pivot and tie it to mental health and it not being linear, which ultimately was a great marketing campaign and message for our community. So ultimately, I think that it was helpful to our brand for our community to see that things are not always perfect or what they seem to be. So that was kind of a little bit different. But no, there wasn't a point where I was like, oh, this is good enough. Yeah.
You seem to have such a connection to the community, the people that buy this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make the job harder or easier?
Easier. Oh, it's so much fun. It makes it so much more easier. And a lot of them are very committed and are involved with helping grow my community just like on their own. They're like volunteering. People are like, I bought your product. I'm going to post it on my social media and try to get you some sales. So that part of it has been really, really fun. And I get a lot of messages and DMs from people and we go back and forth sharing our stories. And I also sent out emails to our community, people that have purchased our product, asking for their honest feedback and, you know, what they would like to see next as a product line at Weightless. And that's also fun, getting their feedback, because the day-to-day is just me. So I don't have a lot of conversation with other people. So when I can really engage with my community, it's special.
We talked about you were, you know, as you grow, you're concerned, can I bring this up? Can I do this at scale? What is the balancing act with wanting to grow, but as you get bigger, it gets harder to maintain the things that make this what it is and keep that connection to the community. Do you worry about if this does get to a point where it's a you're everywhere, are you going to be able to keep what makes it special? And can that specialness be taken to scale, I guess is the question.
I mean, yeah, I would. I always want to be engaged and involved in my community the best way that I can. I think that it's something that I take day by day. Right now, I'm really focused on my short-term goals. Obviously, like scaling looks different for everyone. So when I think of scaling, it's not so much how do I scale the company and business in terms of like financials and product lines, but maybe it's bringing on one employee to help me. So that like right now, I think the next step, once we start to grow, it's looking for someone that can really help me with my company, be a true partner. But I am certainly going to do my best to always have that connection with our community. And we started in Philadelphia, and the people in Philadelphia has helped me grow my community to other states. It's been a lot of gift giving too. So I think that keeping that tied to the people that are involved with helping me build the brand is super important. And it's something that I hope to carry through as we start to scale.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Holly Mershon in just a few moments. But right now, I want to tell you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles. And finally, take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HR-V from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Books KBB.com best value brand. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with former Drexel University women's basketball star Holly Mershon. All right, let's talk a little basketball.
Love it.
So growing up, when did you realize you were pretty good at basketball?
So my entire life, I was a soccer player. I was obsessed with soccer, lived, breathed, ate soccer. That makes no sense. But it wasn't until I was in sixth or seventh grade that I was introduced to the game. And it was my coach at the time that was like, you're pretty good. If you really focus on, you know, your footwork and the different skills, like you could play in college. And from that point, I kind of became obsessed with the game. I was like, okay, then I have something here. And soccer kind of faded into the background. So it was sometime during my middle school career that I was like, okay, maybe we should start focusing on this. And I was at Sacred Heart in Bryn Mawr from sixth to ninth grade. And then I transferred to Carroll for basketball. They were a powerhouse program for basketball. And that really helped propel me and prepare me for what was next, playing at Drexel.
What position did you play soccer-wise?
Soccer, I was all over the place. I was a striker and a midfielder, but then I was also a goalie. I think my favorite position, honestly, was being in the goal, though. But I was a little bit of everything.
Did the soccer skill set help you in basketball?
Oh, sure. I'm sure in many ways. I obviously, with the footwork, there's a lot of footwork in soccer. And soccer is not easy either. But I think just like maybe less about the skills and more about the team dynamic. A soccer, you're on a team with, I don't know, 20 girls sometimes. So just like really understanding the team dynamics and how to work with each other, I think really translates over to basketball because it's a team sport, team dynamic, and chemistry is super important. Skills-wise, I would say the footwork, being able to, soccer is such a big field, and you need to have the ability to read the field, know where your players are, know where your defenders are. And I think that also really helped me in basketball see the court pretty well.
You mentioned the coach that kind of brought you over to basketball says, no, you might be able to play this in college. Like, mm-hmm. You're in sixth, seventh grade. Did that like resonate as, oh, that's awesome? Or was that just like, okay, if you say so? Like, how did you kind of translate that message in your head?
I think it was just kind of like, okay, because at that point, I wasn't even thinking about high school. I was just someone that was obsessed with playing sports. I played pretty much any sport that you can think of. So it was more of like a fun thing. I was having fun, passionate about it. It was something new. So it wasn't like I was like, okay, I really need to focus on this and get my shit together. It was still me having fun and being a kid and figuring out what worked for me. But obviously to hear it in sixth and seventh grade that you could play in college is, you know, a cool feeling.
So you eventually get to Carroll, and you guys were really good, like special good. Like they kind of make documentaries about how good you got teams like this were. Well, you won the Catholic League three times. You won a state title.
Yes, my senior year.
What was that like? And did you appreciate in real time how great that was? Or did it just seem like, well, that's just how it works here?
I think I did appreciate it in real time. I definitely look back and appreciate it more. That team, specifically the team that I played with my senior year when we won states and the PCL, was very special because we were all very dedicated and committed to the game. A lot of us went on to play Division I basketball at different schools, but we also had really good chemistry, and that's very, very rare on and off the court. And I think that we were all very, very talented, and we worked very well as a team. But I don't think that we were the best players compared to some players that we played against. But I think that our team dynamic and the chemistry that we had and understanding the game and understanding our individual roles was really vital in helping us win a championship.
Do you remember the moment when you guys won states and what that was like? Like, take me back there. What's that like?
Yeah, so we actually had back-to-back games with our men's team. They were playing for the state championship. We were playing at Penn State, so I remember it very, very clearly. What a great atmosphere, first of all, to play in a championship game at Penn State. And then a lot of the student body, our cheer section, traveled to Penn State to be there. I feel like we had like maybe 100 kids from our high school be there to cheer us on and obviously to be there with our family. But I mean, it was a journey to get there, and it was the first time that we had competed in states. So it was very new to us. But I think, you know, any championship you win, you're on a high. It feels great. And while I remember it, you kind of do black out a little bit because it's just like it's a surreal, fun moment. And you're celebrating with these girls that you've played with for 3 or 4 years, and you've been through ups, highs and lows and on the court and off the court. So it's just a very surreal moment to share that experience with people who, you know, deserve it.
How does a state championship match up with the Catholic League championship? Because obviously state championship is bigger, but the Catholic League is the Catholic League.
Yeah.
And it's local and it's home and it's like there's something.
It's personal.
That's a great way to put it. Like, how did the winning, and you did it multiple times in the Catholic League, but how were the feelings different, the same? Like, how do you compare them?
That's a good question. I think that no matter what the championship is, I feel like it still feels equally as rewarding. However, with the Catholic League, it is personal. You play against these girls for 3 or 4. I mean, I was at Carroll for 3 years. So most of the time we were playing against these different schools for 4 years. So you know the players on the other team. It's very competitive. You have rivals. Obviously, O'Hara was one of our biggest rivals. And every time we played them, you really didn't know what the outcome was going to be or what was going to happen on the floor. So I think that the Catholic League championship was probably a tad more rewarding just because it's something that you're really working towards the entire season. And, you know, I don't know how this is going to sound, but when you beat your rival school, there's literally nothing better. So it's just a different type of reward at the end of the day.
So you have all this success at Carroll. We talked about, you know, the coach saying you could play this in college. When does it crystallize for you that, yes, I am going to play in college?
I think as soon as I went to Carroll, I saw the possibility. I felt like I got really, you know, great coaching. And I understood at that point what it was going to take for me to make it to that level. And there was girls before me that played at Carroll that went Division I. So obviously there was a lot of attention on our school. So I think like as soon as I transferred there, I definitely saw the possibility, but I really felt like I was coming into my own on that team because I transferred my sophomore year. So I really needed to earn my place and break through. But I feel like my junior year, I felt like I had a breakthrough where I was like, all right, this is a possibility. And I started getting some attention from some D1 schools. And I think I got my first offer actually from Drexel my junior year.
What other schools were really interested?
I was kind of all over the place. I visited different schools in Philadelphia. I went over to Virginia Tech, Mount St. Mary's. Jeez, I feel like my memory as I'm getting older is shot. I think a lot of them were local schools in the Philadelphia area. And then Drexel was very, very interested and kind of on me about going there. And as soon as I visited there, I fell in love with the coaches first. Denise, who's over at Villanova, and Amy Mallon. Melissa Dunn, who's over at St. Joe's now. JC, who's coaching at UCLA. So they kind of sold me on the idea of playing at Drexel. So at the end of the day, it was an easy decision.
Once you start playing college basketball, talk about the transition, even though you're playing high-level high school basketball, but going to Division I, was it overwhelming at first? Did you have any moments of imposter syndrome that I don't know that I can do this, or did you feel relatively comfortable?
So the transition, it was definitely difficult because you go from being, you know, one of the stars on your high school team to starting every game to, I don't think I started one game my freshman year, and I probably averaged, I don't know, 10 minutes a game my freshman year. So that transition was a little bit difficult, but it also was a blessing in disguise because it really made me focus on what I needed to get better at. And I was just even more dedicated and motivated to being the best player I could be. I wanted to be the best. That's, you know, not to sugarcoat it. When I'm playing any sport, I want to be the best on the team. So I did whatever was possible to earn my spot, get on the starting lineup, and, you know, being one of the players that they relied on. So the transition, from that perspective, the transition was definitely eye-opening and challenging. But I think when you are dedicated and motivated to being better, that it's a blessing in disguise.
When you start your career only playing for smaller spurts, how difficult is it to try to not do 100 things at once? Because you're so used to having the game go through you. And then when you've got a smaller role, I just think, especially as a young person, it is just hard to not go 100 miles an hour and try to make all these things happen, because you know you're not going to get the 35 minutes you had been used to.
I think for me, I'm not sure if this answers your question, but I think for me, I really took a step back. I was like, okay, there's other players ahead of me that are better. And I really tried to observe and learn from them and see what they were doing. And also, I had conversations with the coaches like, hey, what can I do that's better? Or what can I improve on to earn a spot and to earn more playing time? So I think instead of focusing on like a million different things, I was really just focused on, you know, how can I earn my spot on the team?
When did you feel like you arrived as a college player?
Probably towards the end of my sophomore year. Towards the end of my sophomore year, things started turning around. There was an opportunity for me to play a little bit of point guard, and I felt like I was able to. I'm not a point guard at heart. I am a shooting guard and attack guard, but I was kind of thrown in that position because of some injuries that were happening on the team. So I felt like I was able to prove myself a little bit there, which I think took the stress off of me, because as a point guard, you're thinking about your teammates and how to set them up and how to run plays instead of me going out there trying to think, how do I score the ball? So I think that playing in a point guard position helped set me up for success and take the pressure off of the type of player that I wanted to be eventually, and helped me develop a whole new part of my game that I didn't have.
And is that where the soccer background, seeing the field, seeing the court, really
helped?
Yeah,
I think so. Yep, having the court vision.
So you mentioned the coaches, and specifically Denise Dillon obviously did incredible things at Drexel and is now doing incredible things at Villanova. Amy Mallon, who's the assistant there, is a head coach now, doing incredible things. And I don't think get enough credit. I don't think Denise got enough credit when she was at Drexel. I don't think Amy gets enough credit now for the success they have at a school like the size of Drexel, mm-hmm. and such. As someone who came through the program, what makes them so good at what they do?
So many things. It's easy for me to just talk about the basketball aspect, but just as like human beings, if you look at a lot of the alumni that came from Drexel, were constantly going back and visiting. Even when Denise was still there, they always made time to keep those relationships going. And you kind of felt, as soon as I walked through the doors at Drexel, I feel at home. You know, you see Denise or Amy's big smile and big hug, and they're quite literally happy to see you. And as basketball coaches, they were tough on me. Denise was the head coach at the time, and I felt like we had a little bit of like a mother-daughter relationship. We bumped heads a bit, but I always knew that she wanted the best for me and that she believed in me. And I think that that's something that I've carried throughout my career as a basketball player and life, just a lot of the lessons that she taught me, and someone that was hard on me but still believed in me. And but just them as human beings, like I, at this point, I feel like I can call them friends. They've been so helpful during my career overseas. They both came to visit me when I tore my ACL overseas for the first time. They've helped me with Weightless in so many different ways. So they've made a huge impact in my life, not just in basketball, outside of basketball as well.
Purely from a basketball standpoint, where do you think you changed the most from a sophomore at Carroll to the end of your Drexel career?
As a basketball player or as a human?
Strictly basketball.
I would say, honestly, I would probably say, that's hard. My junior or senior year in college, I think I really changed as a player and became the type of player that I knew that I could be. And that's honestly from years of hard work and good coaching. And I felt like specifically my senior year, I stepped into a role, a more of like a leadership position. And I felt like I really understood what I was good at and how I can contribute to help my team win. That really clicked for me. When I played at Drexel my senior year, I was a scorer, but I felt like I really understood that if our team wanted to be successful and win, I could not just be a scorer. I needed to find a way to involve them in the game and, you know, set them up for success as much as I was setting myself up for success. My teammates came first and then I came second, and I really understood that my senior year.
And that senior year, you guys end up going to the WNIT and you win the WNIT.
Mm-hmm.
What was that ride like? Because I honestly remember going over to the DAC like four times during that and talking to Denise about mm-hmm. who you guys are playing next and so forth. You know, what was that ride like? And at what point along it did you realize you were in the midst of doing something special? Because if I remember correctly, you guys started at home, mm-hmm. then you traveled, and then you were back home at the end. So just... Yep. What was that like?
That streak was probably one of the most memorable and fun times of my basketball career, I will say. We had my senior year, probably one of my favorite teams that I've ever played with, because our chemistry was just unmatched on and off the floor. And we had just lost the conference championship to Elena Deladon. I refuse to say Delaware, but we had just lost the conference championship, I think, by 2 points. And that was the most devastating loss I've ever been through, quite honestly. We were all crying. Our coaches were crying. We were angry because we wanted it so, so bad. Not to say they didn't want it so bad. And Delaware was just a big rival. So when we got into the WNIT, I think we felt a little bit defeated, because obviously you're goal as a Division I athlete is to make the NCAA tournament, and I didn't do that in 4 years. So I felt a little bit like a failure. But I remember waking up the next morning and I was like, this is not going to be the end of my career. I literally did not want to leave Drexel. I wanted to stay another year. I wanted to play with this team another year. So our team kind of made the decision, all right, this is the end of our careers together. What are we going to do about it? And we were committed to taking this run in the WNIT seriously to win a championship. And it started with the players, and then the coaches were on board, and we were all committed and on the same page to win a championship. And I think we kind of manifested it without really knowing that we did. But those six or seven games? I can't remember.
I believe it was six.
Those six games were the most fun games I've ever played with a team. Just the travel and the journey, and there was no lows. And you probably don't believe me when I say that, but there was literally no lows at that point. One, because we weren't losing, but, you know, we just knew that if we did lose, it was the end of our career together. And then to play at home for the championship game and win, I don't think you can really write a better ending there. So that is a memory that all of us will be able to bond over for the rest of our lives, and I'm very grateful for that.
I talked about the state title versus the Catholic League. How does winning the WNIT compare to the state title?
It's a match. WNIT trumps that every day.
So I'm curious. You mentioned wanting to play in the NCAA tournament. If I could go back in time and say, would you rather make a run to the WNIT and win the championship?
Mm-hmm.
Or get a shot at the NCAA tournament and lose in the first round? What are you saying?
So Holly, before knowing the outcomes, would probably say win the conference, go to the NCAA. Holly now, that's a hard question because, like, what I know now, I think I would probably choose winning the WNIT just because of the memories. And I got to play six more games with that team. It'd be kind of hard to say, no, I'd rather win the CAA. But if you'd asked me before I knew the outcome, I probably would say go to the NCAA tournament.
It's tough.
It's
because,
really tough.
Because your knee jerk is, it's the NCAA tournament, and there's so much coverage,
yeah.
And it means so much to the program, and it means so much financially, just and recruiting and things you can do. But the run you guys went on was so special that is that – I think that's more important than maybe losing by 20 to Arkansas in the first round. Because you guys probably would have been like a 15 or a 16 and would have had a very difficult matchup in the first game. And to hang a banner, to end a career. How many players get to end their career with a win?
That's very true. I didn't think of it like that. But yeah, we were very fortunate. And there was 13 girls on that team plus our coaching staff. So like that's something that we're all going to be able to say we ended up – well. We ended a season, some of them will say we ended a season on a win, which is hard to also say. But yeah, to end my career on a win, I don't think I could trade that up for a loss in the NCAA. And a fun fact, my first game at Drexel, we were playing against Penn State, and I scored my very first point attacking the basket on the left-hand side. WNIT championship, we're playing at Drexel. I score my very last point attacking the basket on the left-hand side. And that, like, still gives me the chills because it's, like, it's weird how that happens. But I started my career the same way I ended my career, and I think that's pretty cool.
When did you realize that?
Oh, after the, like, probably, like, a week after. I honestly don't remember exactly. But it's hard to, like, not remember your first points and your last points.
Time for another break. We will continue our conversation with Holly Mershon coming up. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles. And finally, take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HRV from Honda. The 2025 Kelley Blue Books KBB. KBB.com best value brand. Now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with former Drexel University women's basketball star Holly Mershon. So you play overseas after Drexel. When, like I kind of asked you, when did college become clear?
Mm-hmm.
When did you really start to think like, okay, I'm going to be able to play professionally? Maybe you don't know what it looks like, but when do you start to say, okay, this is obviously going to be an option for me?
Midway through my senior year, I had some agents that reached out to me and they're like, we can try to get you a tryout in the WNBA. So I was hopeful I could get a tryout. It's very competitive. And that did not work out for me. And they were like, well, you can play overseas and you can make decent money over there. And it's still competitive. They have what's called the EuroLeague, which is kind of comparable to the WNBA. A lot of the top Europeans play in that league, and the WNBA players that go over play in EuroLeague or EuroCup when they're not in the WNBA season. So I was like, okay, there'll still be good competition. I still wasn't sold on playing overseas just because I was still very much a homebody, and I don't know that I was scared to go over by myself, but it was just, it was different. It was uncomfortable.
We'll talk about the unknown.
The unknown, yeah. So I literally did everything possible not to go overseas that summer. I think I was trying to play soccer at Drexel at one point for my fifth year and get my master's. That did not work out. But I got a contract the very end of summer to go play in Lithuania in a EuroLeague team. And I was like, okay, I can't really turn this down. And my mom was like, just go. She was like, the first 6 months of anything, she always says that, are the most difficult. But she was like, I think you can do it. And my dad actually flew over with me to Lithuania, my second time in Europe. I had a teammate that was Lithuanian, so that gave me a little bit of comfort, Camille. So yeah, the end of my, or middle of my senior year, I saw that it was a possibility. I wasn't too interested unless it was the WNBA. That didn't work out. And then I got a contract and my parents kind of kicked me out the door and was like, you need to do this or else you're going to regret it.
When did you realize you'd made the right decision?
Not until after the first 3 months of being overseas. It was a culture shock and the coach didn't, she spoke English, but I still needed to like have a translator on the team at points. So it was difficult. I wasn't really playing my best basketball. I don't think my coach was super happy with me. And she literally said to me, she was like, if you don't get your, I'm going to curse again, shit together, we're going to send you home. And that was kind of eye-opening for me because in college, like, unless you're really messing up, not doing well in the classroom, not performing on the court, like, your scholarship is kind of secure, where when you're playing professionally and they're paying you under a contract, it's a whole different ball game. So for someone to say to me that they would send me home was just like, oh crap, like I need to get things together and start performing. I think I was also just like struggling, you know, being away from home and just living in a different country and immersing myself in a different culture. So there was a lot of different factors. And I think my coach ultimately like understood that. She apologized because she said in front of the team, I'm going to send you home. And afterwards, she was like, I probably shouldn't have done that. I know like you're new to this. We'll work with you. And at that point that she did that, I think that was like a month or two into the season, my teammates really started taking me under their wing because they saw like, okay, the coach is hard on her. She's obviously struggling with the transition. And then right around Christmas time, I felt like I was coming into my own. I was connecting with the girls. That was probably the hardest part, connecting with the girls on the team at that point. And yeah, the first 3 months were definitely the toughest. I gave myself a 10-day rule. I said, Holly, if you are upset for 10 days in a row, you can go home. And I would get to day like, I don't know, 7, and I had a great day, and then I had to start over again. So I really tried to commit and stay with it for as long as I could.
Is there a tangible moment? You talk about girls taking you under your wing and stuff like that, but is there a moment you look back as the pivot moment, or was it just gradual?
It was definitely gradual. I think the pivot moment, honestly, was when the coach said to me, if you don't step it up, we're going to send you home. Because at that point, the girls, I think, were like, I don't know that they felt bad or what, but they really started looking after me and helping me and telling me what I could do to improve, especially like with the style game that we were playing and the physicality of everything was a little bit different. And they really want you to perform when you're there. Obviously, you're getting paid. So I think honestly, that was a pivotal moment when she yelled in front of the team what she did. And from there, things kind of went on the up.
I think Lithuania, Portugal, and Sweden were your stops. Was it in that order?
Yes.
How was each different? Or were they all kind of the same experience, just in a different backdrop?
That's a good question. I think culturally they were a little bit different. Or maybe it was because when I went to Lithuania, it was very new for me. The basketball, the country, living far from home. So my transition was a little bit tougher. It was more of a culture shock. And maybe that would have happened if I went to Sweden too for my first time. I think basketball overall was very similar. So overseas, when you're playing, you play in your country's league. So we played in the Lithuanian league, competed against the teams in Lithuania. And we also played in EuroLeague. And there was like, I think maybe 7 to 10 teams in EuroLeague, and you would travel throughout Europe to different countries to compete in this league. The same thing with Portugal and Sweden. I will say I think the Swedish league, some of the teams were a lot stronger than the Lithuanian league. However, EuroLeague was probably the most competitive league that I competed in. So it was the same but different. I don't really have any like true examples of how it was different.
Did you have a favorite country? Was it either one of those three or one of the other places you went to as a visiting team? Like, did you have a favorite place you went to?
Yeah. So to start, I loved every country I played in. Absolutely loved all three of them. Beautiful countries, beautiful cultures, beautiful people, made me feel at home and welcomed. I think because I spent most of the time in Sweden, the 4 out of the 6 years, it's probably my favorite because I really got to immerse myself in the culture, get to know the people. I learned a little bit of the language. I still have friends over there. I have a family that I consider my Swedish family. We travel together. They come to visit me in America. I go over to Sweden to visit them. So if I had to choose one, it would be Sweden that I've lived in. But Italy is my favorite country to visit. I don't really know why. I just, the food, it's beautiful, the culture. So, yeah.
It sounds like you had very stable experiences overseas, because I've talked to a lot of people that have played overseas, specifically overseas basketball. Mm-hmm. And the range of stories you get go from, I still visit my Swedish family, to the plane we were trying to escape from the coup caught on fire.
Yeah.
I'm exact, but
yeah.
You know, but
no,
I mean,
no,
this,
I've heard stories.
You guys,
yeah.
You know, fireworks being thrown onto the court. Just did you have any experience that was just kind of bonkers overseas?
I think like the worst experience I had was our very first game in EuroLeague, where we drove 14 hours on a coach bus over to Poland. That was brutal. And then playing the game and leaving the next day. We also had, they were big on, like, in Europe in general, those small vans. And we're not short women. Like, I don't know what sport they thought we were playing, but we're not short by any means. And they would cram us in these, like, vans. And there's, like, girls that are 6'5 on my team. And we'd be in a van for, like, 3 hours. And I'm just like, so stuff like that. Or we would take overnight trains where they had beds, which, like, wasn't ideal. And then we would get there and we would play literally the same day. So stuff like that was just not what I was used to here playing in the States. I mean, granted, we would sometimes drive 8 hours, but we had plenty of time before our games. So the traveling situation at times was very challenging. But in terms of like people throwing stuff on the floor, I think I lucked out with the countries and teams I played for. I'd have to think about that, but nothing really comes to mind.
I think it would probably resonate right away if you had really gone through something.
I was booed once, so against one of our rival teams overseas, but other than that, no.
Like specifically you?
Oh,
like,
yeah, but I was pretty physical with a girl, so it was, you know, probably appropriate. It's funny. My mom was in the stands. I didn't even realize at the time I was being booed. She was like, you know that the whole stadium booed you, right? I was like, no.
So you mentioned while you're overseas, you tore both ACLs. What's the timeline of when they occur and how close together are they?
So I tore my first ACL at the end of my season in 2016. We were in the semifinals. I was in Sweden. And then 2017... the beginning of the season, the very first game back, I tore my left one.
So you tore
like a year and a half apart.
The right first and then the left?
The right first and the left, correct.
Which was harder? Because the first time it happens, it's the first time that it happens. But the second time it happens, you understand it, but you also know what's in front of you.
Yeah.
So there's different weights you're carrying with each of them. Which one was harder for you?
The first one was definitely harder for me because I didn't know what to expect, and that was really scary. That was also during the time when I struggled a lot with my anxiety. I probably lost 15 to 20 pounds the first month after surgery. It was hard for me to eat. And
these were the first times you had ever really been hurt,
yes,
right? Like you mentioned
sprained ankle.
Like just,
yeah. So not being able to play your sport and being sidelined is just a whole other experience. And I, obviously, as an athlete, your goal is to come back from it. And you, I always believed that I could, but there was still some level of doubt that I held, that I felt like I couldn't control if my body or my knee did not respond the way it was supposed to. Like, yes, I can put in all the work and time into rehab and lifting and conditioning, but there was still a part of me, well, what if my body just doesn't respond the way it's supposed to? So that was very, very scary and also caused me a lot of anxiety. Also, with my first knee, for some reason, I was in so much pain. Like, I wasn't really sleeping. And then with my second knee, I knew as soon as I went down that I tore my ACL because it was the same pain, same feeling, same pop. And while it sucked and I knew the road ahead of me, I knew that I could do it. So I didn't really have any doubt or fear. Now, I didn't know what it would look like when I came back after having rehab both knees, like if I would be slower. But it's funny, I was never really a lifter in college. I kind of always, like, I shouldn't say this, but I kind of always faked it a little bit. But tearing my ACLs, I really needed to focus on my leg strength, and I became a better defender because of it. Like, I could go laterally my last season that I was back. I think I made, like, one of the defensive teams. And I think if you asked anyone, they'd be like, Holly Marchand is on the defensive team. No way. So, but long story short, the right was definitely tougher. The left one, while I knew it was ahead, I knew that I could do it, and I knew what I needed to do to get back.
One last break for this episode of 101 with Matt Leon. Want to remind you that 101 with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles and finally take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HR-V from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand. And now on 101 with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with Holly Marchand.
From a mental health standpoint during this stretch, was there a moment that you look back on and was kind of like the worst you felt or the bottom?
Yeah, when I came back from overseas.
It was not the injury so much as it was when it was just all over.
Yeah, I think, like, because I can remember a little bit how I felt when I tore my first ACL to me retiring. And I would say that how I was struggling when I retired was worse than the anxiety I was dealing with my knee.
Were you able to retire on your terms, or was it just nobody was calling anymore?
I was able to retire on my own terms. I will say I didn't have... So when I came back from my final season after I tore both my ACLs, it was my sixth season overseas, 2018-2019. I was committed to playing a full season without being injured, which I did. When that season ended, my knee was in so much pain, my right knee, that there was no way that I felt like I could play another season. I don't remember if I had conversations with the Swedish team if I would come back. I think at that point, like, they pretty much knew I was done, and my agent wasn't really looking for me anymore. And at the same time, teams weren't reaching out like they were when I was healthy because, you know, Europe is small over there. The basketball community is small, so they kind of know. I think that if I wanted to continue to play, it would have been a lot of work on my end to get to a point where I was pain-free. I couldn't play through the pain anymore.
Because it was on your terms, but it was because your body was starting to betray you, for lack of a better term. Like, was there an uncomfortableness with the decision because it was kind of forced on you? I mean, it was forced on you by your knee, but you just hadn't kind of hit the point where you're like, you know what? It's not as much fun anymore, and I want to get back to the States. And it was more, Jesus, this hurts, and I don't know if I can climb this mountain again. Like, do you think you might have been in a better place if it had been completely just because you felt like it was time?
Do you think I would have been in a better place after I retired?
Yeah, mentally.
No, because
the lack of losing basketball, regardless of what it looked like.
Yeah. So, like, my feel like the challenges that I faced wasn't so much that my ACL injuries forced me out of the game, because when I tore both of my ACLs, I kind of came to terms with that. Like, OK, I'm probably towards the end of my career. I was able to navigate that the best way that I could. And I was really happy with my last season overseas in Sweden. We ended up winning a championship, the first championship for that club. And I loved that team. I had a really great positive experience. I came back from two ACL surgeries, which I didn't think was going to be possible. So when I retired, I felt at peace. It was time. While, like, maybe I would have still played if I didn't have knee injuries, I think that ultimately it was time for me to come home. So I felt good about it. So no, I think that, like, if I technically went out on my own terms, it wouldn't have changed what I dealt with after I retired.
When did you start to feel like that after you retired? Was it immediately or
no?
The first few months, I guess you can just kind of convince yourself that it's just like the off season. It's not until it's time to get back into the grind that something's different. Was that when it kind of hit?
Yeah, when I came back right before COVID happened too. So I was still living at home with my parents. And I was in this transition phase of, I was interviewing for jobs. I worked for a development company, Toll Brothers, but I was in the midst of like interviewing. And as soon as they were about to hire, they went on a hiring freeze and then COVID happened. And COVID, I didn't really struggle during COVID. I think it was kind of what I needed to like decompress, take a step back. And like, it actually helped me transition, which sounds weird, like back to normal life. I think it wasn't until probably 3 years ago when I started Weightless or began the process of starting Weightless that I really started to struggle. I had left the company, Toll Brothers, that I was with and went to another company and just started to really realize, like, I am not doing something that I love. Like, I'm continuing to, like, look for jobs and none of them are fulfilling me in a way that I was fulfilled with basketball. So it was kind of like a reality check at that point. And I actually had someone ask me, like, what's your dream job if you don't want to do this? And I looked at him and said, I have already had my dream job. And he was like, oh, I haven't really thought about it that way. Playing basketball overseas was my dream job and I accomplished that. And then it's kind of like, what now? And I think at that point, probably 3 years ago, so 2023, it really hit me, and the struggles that I went through with my identity and my purpose, it was a really tough moment for me because I'm like, am I just going to wake up every day and just be like blah? And that's a scary thought. Like, if you don't have a purpose in life, then, like, you know, what's next for you? So there was some time after I retired where, you know, things felt normal and good, but it ended up catching up with me eventually when I realized that nothing I was doing was fulfilling me the same way as playing basketball or being an athlete.
How did it manifest itself? Like, would you get upset or would you just kind of shut down, or was it not the same all the time? Did it manifest itself in different ways in your darkest moments?
There was ups and downs. I think that I woke up with like a lot of anxiety most of my days. I think that that's how it showed up the most. And I was grieving without realizing I was grieving. You know, from the age of 4, I started playing sports. I think I started playing soccer and I swam starting at the age of 4. So I was doing that for, I'm not good at math, but like almost 30 years. And when that's over, and you can't really go, but there's ways that you can still be around the game, but like competing, that's done. And that's it was a form of grief that I was going through. I was sad and I didn't really realize it at the time. So it would show up in different ways. And I think it really showed up when I was doing something that I didn't love because I was reminded of it. And I didn't feel like I was leading a life with purpose. Now with basketball, like, I got so much fulfillment out of it, but there was some purpose behind it because, you know, when you're an athlete, you have a platform, you can inspire people. There's, you know, young kids that would come to our game and look up to us and you would sign autographs. So there was still purpose there within that. And I just kind of felt like, and also with basketball, the teams I was involved in, like, we were always giving back and volunteering, and I had kind of lost that along the way when I retired. So it showed up in different ways at different times for different reasons, but I was grieving.
Because of that, Were you able to look back on your career and be happy, or did you not look back on it like you probably should have because of maybe that melancholy mm-hmm. that would come along that you're not doing that anymore? Because that's – you're grieving, but you're also – you're kind of losing twice. You're not playing basketball, but – if you can't look back with joy at those moments, you're losing those moments in a way as well, if I'm making sense.
No, it makes sense. I look back at those moments with joy. And I think sometimes that makes it worse because, like, I had so much fun and I just miss it so much. So it's this, like, it's this weird feeling because my experience being an athlete and a basketball player, like middle school, high school, college, professional, they were all positive experiences. I have so many great stories. I've grown in so many ways from those experiences. So when I look back, they're very happy times, but it's almost just like, oh, I want to go back to those times because they were some of the best times of my life. So I don't look at it in a negative way whatsoever. I think if any type of emotion comes up, yes, it's happy and joy, but also I miss it.
Have you ever thought of coaching?
Yes. So when I came back from overseas, I had someone reach out to me and offer me a position at Malvern Prep, which is an all boys school, to coach the freshman boys basketball team. That was so much fun. I loved it. And I did that for 3 years, and then I couldn't keep doing it because of the job that I had. But ultimately, what I tell people is my entire life was focused on sports, the irregular schedules, not being able to go to all the holidays, birthday parties, celebrations, having to miss out on your weekends. I'm just kind of over that. I like – now I'm an entrepreneur and I do not have a normal schedule because I work 7 days a week, but it's different. I can control it. So I just – I wanted to be on a normal schedule. I wanted to have my weekends. I wanted to be able to show up for things that I wanted to show up for. So while I have thought about it, I don't think it's for me, at least right now. But I would be interested in training like individual athletes, working on their skills, shooting and whatnot. But I think college coaching, I'm not sure if it's for me.
Given where you are now and the path you had to travel from 2019 to 2023-ish to kind of get here, mm-hmm. if you had the option, would you change anything?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I don't think so. As much as I would love to say, like, I wish I didn't struggle, it led me to turn pain into purpose and help other people. And it also, I don't know that if I didn't go through that period of struggling, if I would have started a company. So the short answer is I would change nothing.
Holly Mershon, this has been a journey. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that will do it for this edition of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Holly Mershon, former Drexel University women's basketball star and founder of the lifestyle brand and clothing line Weightless, for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
The pressure on data centers has never been greater. Whether you're expanding capacity, supporting AI workloads, or building new facilities, Graybar works alongside you with the solutions, specialists, and logistics expertise you need today. We help you power performance every step of the way, so your operation is ready now. Yep, Graybar does that.
T-Mobile has an exclusive bundle for customers 55 and up.
I'm Sarah Bowl.
Yeah, I'm Frank Bowl.
A reliable network is key for us. And with T-Mobile, it's been wonderful. And going to the 55 plus plan saved us so much money.
A lot.
And that's important.
trying to keep costs down. The home internet's been perfect. It's fast, it's quick. The setup was so easy, it took less than 15 minutes.
It was like, ta-da! If you want simplicity, coverage, reliability, you want the whole package, T-Mobile has it.
Right now, T-Mobile customers 55 and up can get two phone lines on America's best network, plus America's fastest 5G home internet for just $30 each.
$30 per month each line with auto pay plus taxes and fees. Minimum age 55. Pricing for home internet relies on 2 lines of Essentials Choice 55. $35 connection charge per line required. Best mobile network and fastest 5G home internet based on analysis by Ookla of Speedtest Intelligence data 2H 2025. All rights reserved.
Latte for Keenan?
That's me.
Hey, you're...
Yeah.
Buying a car online on AutoTrader?
Really? But unlike other sites, you can start online, test drive with a local dealer, then finish online or at the dealership.
Really? Wait, are you...
Yep, it's Keenan.
Able to finish in person without starting the process over?
Really? Your info stays with you every step of the way.
Cool. Enjoy.
It's Keenan Thompson. Buy your car online on AutoTrader. Really?
Las Vegas was built for stars. And on August 22nd, two of boxing's biggest take center stage. Rolly Romero never follows the script.
This is my game.
Teofimo Lopez has never needed one.
This guy's got a big mouth.
For years, they've had plenty to say.
All you do is talk.
But with world championship gold on the line, can they back it?
Teo, I'm here. I'm going all in.
It's time to put up or shut up. Rolly Romero versus Teofimo Lopez. August 22nd.
I'll shut you up.
Watch on DAZN and DAZN on Prime Video.
Girl, let's get real. Some pads are just diapers with a good PR team, but not the new Kotex BioCare. That's because Kotex BioCare helps defend against odor and irritants. And it's the first and only pad with this pH proactive system that helps optimize the pad's pH. Just think of it as self-care for down there. Check out Kotex.com for more details on the all-new Kotex, completely redesigned to meet your needs. You asked, we heard.